Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to MidRap, where the Navy Millblog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, to the 25 April 2010 edition of MidRaps. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with the co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. This week, we're going to cover a 50-year timeline within 1 hour. We're going to go from the Vietnam War and its aftermath to the options the Navy is looking at in 2010. In order to do that today, we're going to be helped by our two guests. Our first guest will be retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel J.G. Zumwalt and journalist Greg Grant. So kick back, enjoy yourself, and thanks again, whether you're here live or you're catching us on the archive on Blog Talk Radio or subscribing to the podcast on iTunes. This is a reminder for those who are with us live. Make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page with the usual suspects. That way, if you have a question or an observation or you'd like us to clarify something with one of our guests, you can come onto the chat room. Eagle One will ride herd on that, and he'll fold in your questions or concerns as we go forward. Well, let's get right to our first segment. We're going to be discussing with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Zumwalt his new book, Bare Feet, and Iron Will, Stories from the Other Side of Vietnam's Battlefields. Just for a little bit of his background, Lieutenant Colonel Zumwalt is a retired Marine infantry officer who served in the Vietnam War, the 1989 intervention in Panama, and Desert Storm. He is an author, speaker, and business executive, and he currently heads a security consulting firm named after his father, Admiral Zumwalt and Consultants Incorporated. His articles on Vietnam, North Korea, foreign policy, and defense issues can be found in a variety of newspapers and magazines, USA Today, Washington Post, New York Times, Washington Times, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, San Diego Union, Parade, and others. He's also a member of the Committee on Present Danger, and from 91 to 92, he was a senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs. Obviously, with a guest like Jim, we could do 4 or 5 shows, but we're really going to try to focus today's show on his book, some of the things that we can gather from it, and some new insights that he developed in the process of getting this book. And if you like what you hear, tomorrow at the Navy Memorial in Washington, D.C., if you're within a commute, he is going to be there for a book signing. So, Jim? Finally, I'd like to welcome you to MidRaps. Thank you very much for coming on board.
Thank you for having me.
And Jim, as we kick off, just give us an overview of how you came to write Barefoot and Iron Will and what it kind of makes it different than a lot of books that have been written about Vietnam.
Well, every male member of my family served in Vietnam, and we didn't find out till years later that my brother suffered from the effects of Agent Orange. He passed away in 1988, and with his death, I personally started feeling a lot of animosity toward the enemy we had fought there about the war. And I found that when tragedy occurs in somebody's family, there's two ways you can handle it. One is to transfer it into positive energy and try to do something good with it, and the other is to transfer it into negative energy and let it take a hold of you. And I unfortunately did the latter. My father did the former, and he really threw himself into the Agent Orange issue, trying to do what he could to fight for benefits for our Vietnam veterans. In 1994, he was able to schedule a meeting with the president of Vietnam to discuss the opportunity of doing a joint study on Agent Orange, and asked me if I'd like to go with him. Initially, I was reluctant to do so, but decided to go with him. And I found as we met with the North Vietnamese officials, a lot of the animosity again welling up. It wasn't until the third day we had a meeting with a Major General Phan, who was a medical doctor, and he started the meeting off by extending his condolences to me about the loss of my brother. And as we started talking about the war and its impact, I noticed the general got a little teary-eyed, and I didn't find out until later in the conversation that he, too, had lost a brother in the war. And that really was kind of a awakening moment for me, as I realized that it doesn't matter which side of the battlefield you were on. If you lost a loved one, it was a significant event in both of our lives. And because of that awakening, I decided to return to Vietnam to learn more about what I could, about what the war was like from their side of the battlefield. I ended up making a total of 50 trips between 1994 and 2004, meeting with hundreds of North Vietnamese and Viet Cong veterans, as well as civilians, and was able to get the bulk of my material that way for the book, Bare Feet, Iron Will.
Eagle One.
Well, as I understand what you did, you actually went back and interviewed, you went back more than 50 times and interviewed a whole bunch of people. And it sounds like you came back with some insight both into where we went wrong in the war and lessons we could learn for the future. Without asking to summarize the entire book, could you kind of touch on those issues?
Well, I guess the simplest way to answer your question, that there was an anti-war song that was popular during the Vietnam War, and I won't sing it to you, but a refrain of it went, and it's 1, 2, 3, what am I fighting for? Don't know, and I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. I found the question asked in that refrain something that weighed heavy on my mind as I did these interviews. And that was the question, what are we fighting for? And I think if I put that question to many of their veterans, and what became clear to me was that while what we were fighting for on our side of the battlefield was confusing, I think, for most of us, that on their side of the battlefield it was much less confusing. And the thing that became clear to me was that while we may have felt that we were fighting communism, it really wasn't communism that we were confronting in the Vietnam War. It was a feeling of nationalism. That became very, very clear to me in the interviews that I did. And as I was educated on their 1,000 years of history in which they have repeatedly had to deal with a foreign occupier, most of the time it's been the Chinese, but the common denominator is that every foreign occupier that came into the country was eventually driven out.
Jim,
we don't often get a Country Joe and the Fish reference on this show, but I'll give you that. Now, you talk in the outline of the book. I see there's a section on patience, and it's part of what you're talking about, that they were fighting for nationalism and perhaps what they perceived to be freedom from an empire. Is that part of the patience difference between what our American people had and what the Vietnamese were fighting for?
I think they manifested their patience in many different ways. Let me just give you an example. I found it interesting when I asked them for dates when something happened. they talked about an encounter or a battle or whatever. And for the most part, they put things in reference to whether or not it was the dry season or the monsoon season. And the reason for that is their tours of duty in Vietnam were much, much longer than ours were. The opening chapter I talked about, Dr. Lee Cao Dai, who left his wife and child, telling them that he'd be back in 6 months to a year. He spent 8 years in the South, only getting back once to visit his family. But because they were there for the long run and didn't know how long they would have to fight, but they really were very patient in doing what they had to do to be able to win.
Jim, the accounts I've read of a lot of veterans and just normal Americans in the last few years who have gone to Vietnam to visit, one thing that has continually come up in their write-ups that I've been able to get hold of is that the Vietnamese people were very friendly, very warm to them. You can't call it pro-American, but they didn't really detect a hostility or a resentment that they thought they were. They were pleasantly surprised by the reception they received in Vietnam. What type of reception did you get? I know you were there in a little more of a high profile than a lot of people are, but how do you account for a lot of those reports, and does that parallel what you saw when you started going to Vietnam?
Well, I think that comment is 100% on point. As I said, I made my first trip in 94 before relations between the two countries had been normalized, and so I really was not expecting to be welcomed in such a warm fashion. But I think there again, it's a tribute to the Vietnamese people. They have an amazing capacity to forgive and forget. Here we had fought what at that point in time was the longest war we had ever fought against them, yet they were able to reach out to us and welcome us when we came to visit.
Eagle One.
Yeah, Jim, I noticed that you indicate, though, that even with all the mistakes we made in the war, that we still, if we hadn't fought in Vietnam, we would have ended up fighting somewhere in Southeast Asia. Can you explain that?
Well, the Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, many years ago made that observation himself. As we were pulling out of Vietnam, he said it would take historians a while to recognize it, but it was his personal belief that had the United States not fought the war in Vietnam, that they would have had to fight it elsewhere. And what was accomplished by fighting in Vietnam was that we gave the other countries in that region an opportunity to develop their economies to the point where the soil did not become fertile for the seed of communism to take root. And he, as he said, it's going to take historians a while to recognize that, but he thinks when the final chapter on the Vietnam War is written, that will be one of the findings.
When I was, this is Sal again, when I was reading some of your background material, and it was good to see, again, because I don't think you hear it enough, because the question comes out a lot, you know, the loss of 58,000 Americans, was it worth it? And the answer was, yes, it was worth it. It's come so long that we can have this conversation for those that served in Vietnam, but I think history has borne that out when people are willing to take a deep breath and, you know, look at it from a little far back and to see what was done and why it was done in a macro sense. If going from the macro down to the micro, I thought from a personal point of view, one of the things in your book that kind of caught me is in your research and your interviews, you found out about a plot to assassinate your father. I wonder if you could take a minute and tell us about that.
Okay. One of the officials I had asked to meet with was the commanding general of the Coochie Tunnel Fighters, and for those who are familiar with the Coochie Tunnel system, and for those who are not, it was a massive tunnel system, about 300 and, a network about 320 kilometers in length, located about 30 or 40 miles outside of Saigon. And the purpose of my meeting with the commanding general was to learn what life was like in the tunnels, how they had constructed them. And towards the end of the interview, he made mention of the fact that he had conducted attacks on targets in and around Saigon. When he started rattling off a list of targets, and one of which was the Navy headquarters. And when he said that, I kind of caught my attention, and I said, "Is that the U.S. Navy headquarters or the South Vietnamese Navy headquarters?" And he said, "It was the U.S. Navy headquarters." And I said, "By any chance, would that have been 1969?" And he said, "Yes, it was." And it turned out that this is the fellow who had masterminded an assassination attempt against my father when my father had commanded the naval forces in Vietnam. He had obviously heard about the incident when it had occurred in, as I recall, it was May of 1969. And I was fascinated now to learn the other side as to the planning that went into it and how they felt it was important to try to knock my father off, since the Navy was doing such a great job in cutting back on the supply routes in the South. When the interview was over, we stood up and shook hands, and my father was still alive at this time, and the general said, "When you see your father next, give him my apologies, but tell him I was only doing my job as a soldier." And I said, "General, the fortunate thing is you missed." And went back to my hotel that evening and immediately called my father to tell him about it. And I ended the conversation by telling him, "By the way, Dad, I gave him your new address." And I received a hearty laugh from him.
Eagle One.
Well, speaking of the riverine warfare and the interdiction efforts that your father implemented as part of the part of his efforts there in Vietnam, another part of your book is about the ingenuity of the North Vietnamese and getting materials and supplies to their forces in the South. Could you talk a little bit about that? Did you discuss a lot more than the tunnels did you go over the Ho Chi Minh Trail and stuff?
Sure. I think again in the first chapter, going back to Dr. Lee Caldai, this was a gentleman who was ordered to form a field hospital, had a staff of about 400, and equipped it, and then had to travel down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to get down to the southern battlefields. On their way along the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they were subjected to bombing attacks. They ended up losing about 90% of their medical supplies. So when they finally made it down to the south, although their personnel had survived, their supplies had not, and they had to go out and look at a way of replenishing their supplies. And what they did was they found that they really had an unsuspecting party providing them with the replenishment, and that was the U.S. government. What they would do is they would find unexploded ordnance, they would disarm it, they would melt the metal down, use that for surgical tools. If they came across a aircraft crash site, they would immediately strip the aircraft of whatever they could use. For example, they would take the insulated wiring, they would remove the wire and just use the rubber tubing as an IV tube. The fuselage would be cut lengthwise and then into sections and halved so that it would become a brace for a broken arm, a broken leg. Periodically, our forces were dropping parachute flares on their positions at night. The next day, they would go out and collect these parachute flares. The parachutes themselves would be ripped up to be used as bandages. The threading in the parachutes could be used to as sutures. There was absolutely nothing that went to waste. Anything that they could use, they would they would incorporate.
When compared to some of the people here, I'm still pretty much of a young pup. I just retired last year. And throughout my career, I served both officer and enlisted, not just Navy, mostly Navy and Marine Corps, surprisingly, but that's what the circles I ran in. But I served with a lot of people who came to America after 1975 as Vietnamese refugee children and grew up here and are serving in the military. And the stories they would tell were amazing, as you would expect, people who are plucked out of the sea and then come to a very foreign culture. And many of them, their father was in the South Vietnamese military. Is there a book out there that looks at a South Vietnamese story in the way that, that you're telling the story of the North Vietnamese, kind of in that same context that you have, it's really personalized it, or is that book something that still has yet to be written?
It's interesting because, but first of all, I'll say I know of no book that's out there that's directly on point. But the reason I say your question is interesting is a very good friend of my father's in Vietnam was his South Vietnamese counterpart, Admiral Chan. And the story, I have interviewed Admiral Chan and his children, and it is an amazing story of survival and what they endured to make their way to this country. That's a story that I've, as I said, I've done the interviews, and I hope eventually I'll do into a book myself. And I didn't put you up to that question.
No, not at all. But hey, we'll take the tee up, Eagle One.
Well, I want to connect your book and your experience in the past to some of the indigenous forces we seem to be fighting today, and I'm not finding a great deal of difference in having to you know, the ingenuity of the Afghan people or the Taliban or whoever we're fighting over there, and some of the groups in Iraq. We seem to be back and reinventing the same wheels with a modern warrior group going against, if not Stone Age, 1856 type warriors. Can you connect those things for me?
Well, let me say this: if you go back 2,500 years ago to a book written by a brilliant Chinese military strategist by the name of Sun Tzu, The Art of War, in his book, he enunciates various principles of warfare that a commander should master. And one of those is you never engage an enemy on the battlefield unless you know that enemy first. I think part of our problem has been that we have been hit first by the enemy, so we don't necessarily know who the enemy is beforehand to be able to get a better appreciation of the mindset. So we're kind of behind the eight ball when war erupts. That said, I think there is a significant difference between the enemy we fought in Vietnam and the enemy we're fighting today in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that is this: the Vietnamese were every bit as motivated as we were to survive the war, to return home to families, and to have a better life. The militants that we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq do not have that same motivation. They really see death as a vehicle to an afterlife where they get their reward. So they are not motivated by the same sense of wanting to return to family and home. That doesn't matter to them at all. And when you're dealing with somebody like that, they're a much, much more dangerous enemy to deal with.
When we're looking back at the lessons of the Vietnam War, which I think is an overused phrase because we're still talking about it,
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
I'm sorry, you know, we're talking about some of the things that we can learn about Vietnam And everybody always talks about that, because I don't think we've started to recently, I think, have a more of an open dialogue on it. One of the things that I get really frustrated with when I'm trying to talk about the Vietnam War, which isn't my war, I just know it by what I read about it, people I talk to about it, and what is a small kid I remember seeing on TV. But in 1972, South Vietnam was invaded by North Vietnam in a quasi-conventional attack. They defeated that attack, but they had a lot of help, especially from U.S. Naval and Air Forces, to defeat that attack. And 3 years later, they were invaded again in 75. But the big difference there is our strategic center of gravity, which was always in Washington, D.C., fell when the U.S. Congress pulled back its funding and military support, and South Vietnamese, as they fell and lost their capital in 75. How do you explain that to people, besides that brief outline, that really kind of tells that story of how South Vietnam really fell in 75?
Well, I think the simple answer is it was outright abandonment of an ally. When in 1973 at the Paris Peace Accords, we had made an agreement with the South Vietnamese that we would continue to supply them with arms and other things, and what we did was get them to sign on, and then we proceeded to desert them. And the sad thing about it is that the South Vietnamese, really by that point in time, by 1973, had become a fairly effective fighting force, and it took the Vietnamese, as you pointed out, three additional years before they were able to drive south and affect the collapse of Saigon. There's no way to explain it other than the fact that, and I see it as a black mark in our history, that we abandoned an ally that we had promised we would be there for them.
And with somebody that has school-age kids, one of the frustrations for me is when I read their history textbooks when it covers the Vietnam War, it doesn't cover it, the way that it actually happened. Do you see in our schools that there's been an advance in how Vietnam is being taught, or is it kind of stuck in a rut and more work needs to be done to get it taught properly?
I think the tendency by a majority of history teachers in high school and colleges is to mention the Vietnam War, but not really go into detail on it. And to me, that is very frustrating, because, as you well know, that's the first law, the first war we failed to win. What has been encouraging to me, on the other hand, is the fact that there are some teachers. In fact, there's a program at a high school in Raleigh, North Carolina, Millbrook High School, run by a teacher by the name of Linda Poling, who has put together what she calls the Love Program, Lessons of Vietnam. And in this program, she goes into a lot of detail about the war, but at the beginning of the semester, she links each student up with somebody who has a firsthand perspective of the war. It could be a veteran, it could be a refugee, it could be a protester, it could be a nurse. But these students then are able periodically during the course to ask questions of these people who experienced the war to get a better understanding as to what really went on. And I just wish we had a lot more Lindy Polings out there teaching than we do.
Amen. And I think we have time for one more question, Eagle One.
Well, Jim, out of all the lessons of Vietnam, we could learn, what is one that sticks out for you as the most important we should have learned?
Well, I think the most important is never underestimate the capabilities of your enemy. we totally underestimated what the Vietnamese were capable of. We were a superpower. They were a third-rate power, third-world power, and we just didn't see any way they could stick it out in a slugfest. But the creativity they used, the ingenuity they used, the patience they used was phenomenal, and that was what carried them through to victory.
And Jim, as we come to the bottom of the hour, the first thing I wanted to do was thank you very much for coming out here and spending 30 minutes with us to talk about your book and also let us ask you some questions about Vietnam, something that we've wanted to do on our show here for a while, and a topic that doesn't get talked about as much as it does right now. And to end things off, I wonder if you could take a minute, and if any of our listeners in the D.C. area would be interested to come by tomorrow at the Navy Memorial for your book signing, I wonder if you could give us a little detail on that.
Yes, it'll be at 12 noon tomorrow, Monday the 26th. It's part of a series called Author on Deck. The Navy Memorial hosts an author who has written a military-related publication, and I'm next up at bat.
Well, we wish you luck, and look forward to talking to you down the road. Jim, thank you very much for coming on Mid-Wraps.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Jim.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you.
And just as a quick reminder to everybody, you're listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio, Mid-Wraps. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Our next guest is Greg Grant. He's a national security and defense writer and also edits the Defense Tech blog as associate editor with military.com. His writings on military technology and international security have appeared in Foreign Policy, Slate, The Washington Post, The LA Times, Defense Technology International, The Washington Quarterly, Survival, Government Executive Magazine, and, of course, National Journal. He has a little bit of a background in this war, you could say. He arrived in Baghdad in April of 2003 with the 3rd Infantry Division, and he returned a number of times to cover the war there. He's reported for James Defense Weekly from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Military Times newspapers. Before taking interest in journalism, he worked as a military analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He holds an M.A. in Strategic Studies from Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Greg, welcome to Mid-Wraps.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Good deal. Hey, we exchanged a few emails here earlier this month, and what I wanted to kind of use as a kickoff here, as we've gone from the early 70s, is to look forward to the 2020s, or what I like to call the terrible 20s. I put on my economist hat, my budgetary hat, and I just see a train wreck coming. And the Center for Naval Analysis put out a work that you commented on the 31st of March. And I wonder if you could take for a second and give us a real quick overview of what you thought of that CNA study.
Okay. Well, it was interesting. CNA came out with this report titled "The Navy at a Tipping Point, Maritime Dominance at Stake?" And what they're trying to look at is there a tipping point where the Navy begins to lose influence overseas, and its impact is diminished, and what size of fleet, at what number or numbers do you start losing that influence overseas? And so they look out, say, 20, 30 years, and as you mentioned, they see in fiscal deficits as far as the eye can see, no real increases in DoD funding. And as we all know, a bit of a squeeze going on within the budget itself as personnel costs rise, and things like procurement for ships may get squeezed pretty good here. So they looked at a number of different futures and what options the Navy could do. They basically said the status quo going as they have procurement, at least procurement-wise, as they have over the last few years, the last decade even, where they're buying, you know, anywhere between 6 and 8 ships a year, that's not going to cut it. That's going to end up with out somewhere around 2025, 2030, you're going to end up with a fleet about 230, 240 ships versus today's 286 ship Navy. And so what they tried to do is come up with alternative strategies. So given that that reality, then what do you do? And then and they started from the position of the Navy. The Navy has always based their overseas their posture, if you will, on a two-hub approach, having a hub in the Western Pacific and a hub in the Northern Arabian Sea and the Gulf area. And whether they can maintain that two-hub strategy is a real question mark now, if you're looking at a battle fleet of around, you know, 240 ships. And so they thought maybe they cut one of the hubs down to maintaining a good carrier strike groups in the Western Pacific and cutting them out, pulling some of them out of the Persian Gulf region, or if you could switch to maybe a dual mode Navy, if you will, where you have a lot of amphibious ships and a lot of littoral combat ships that can do the kind of the presence missions and engagement missions, and yet maintain a few carrier strike groups for the Western Pacific. It was just really interesting in the way they looked at different proposals for a new strategy, basically, is what they were saying. So,
and in theory, you know, strategy drives your shipbuilding budget. But I think one thing that caught me as well, and I think it was either a graph in that report or another one that showed the break where we went from double-digit shipbuilding to single-digit shipbuilding. And I also like something you pulled out in your article where, you know, here we are in 2010. We have, you know, 20% fewer ships than we had just a short while ago, but we're still deployed the same number of years. And if you're building 6 to 7, like you said, we're looking at 230 to 240 ships by 2025. About 4 years ago, over my home blog, we started pounding away on this because you constantly heard 313, 313, 313. But that outside of the Beltway, that made absolutely no sense when you looked at how much they were spending and the cost increases for whether you're talking about LPD-17, you're talking about LCS, the now canceled DDG-1000. And the fact that when you look at, and this is before the train wreck of debt projections came up in the last 2 years, and you also looked at the fact we'll have to recapitalize our strategic defense starting in the 2020s, that there's no way that you're going to get there when you are taking what few ships do you have. For instance, FFG-8 is decommissioned now and is going to go work for the Turks for a few years, and we didn't maintain our Spruances well enough, so they went away. So here we are. We'll be lucky if we get to 230 to 240 by 2025, but 20% fewer ships going the same number of days at sea. It doesn't take a metallurgist to tell you what that's going to do to your ability to get these ships to last. But we've had leadership for 5 years yelling at 313. How did we get here to this point, do you think, that we can no longer just nod our heads at the words because the facts are beating us over the head? How did we get here from a leadership point of view?
Well, that's a good question. You know, why has no one honestly addressed this shipbuilding plan that, like you said, I mean, especially when they start, as you mentioned, recapitalizing the ballistic missile submarines. I mean, you're talking about $7-8 billion potentially per submarine, and how do you cram that into a $13 billion a year shipbuilding budget? You know, you just simply can't do it. And I'm struck that no one's willing to honestly discuss this. No one. I don't see it. I don't hear it from the Navy leadership of how they're going to arrest this decline somehow in ship numbers. And I really worry because, as I mentioned, I think the personnel costs are that's something that's going to really get worse and worse as we go down there, and not just the Navy, but across the services, and really going to put the squeeze on any kind of available procurement funding. And so that's a good question. You know, who steered us down this course? I'm not sure where that blame lies. I'm just surprised that no one's willing to have this honest discussion. I mean, I was talking to a gentleman at a conference recently who's in the Secretary of the Navy's office, and he said they just want their LCS, they want their new ships, and they're not willing to confront some of these realities. I think they can pass this on to somebody else, and it's, I don't know, I don't see how they pull it off, but maybe they know something we don't know.
Yeah, I think they know when their PCS orders end and it's somebody else's problem. Eagle One.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. One is that I noticed you had a recent article on the line of sight missile system that was going to be used for the LCS, which seems to have been tanked by the Army. Maybe you can address that and what that does to this forward presence issue with the LCS. And the other one is you talk about in your piece on with the CNA about the powerful home fleet surge forward, and I guess that the conversation here with the reduction of the number of ships to that powerful surge seems to be missing somewhere. Can you kind of explain that?
Yeah, on the surge thing first, I mean, that was an option they're talking about, kind of the home fleet option, if you will, where you maintain a fleet strong enough that can surge out into to deal with potential problems, but you don't maintain that forward presence that we have for the past 50 plus years. And so what does that do? Are we still a global maritime power at that point? I don't think so. I don't think if we're not able to maintain, especially in the Western Pacific, if we're having to pull back out of the Western Pacific, even cut down, I don't know, the number of cruises they're doing currently. I mean, I just think we really risk losing influence in that vitally important area. I could see them, and it was interesting, and some of the options they talked about and that made sense was maybe reducing the number of strike groups we keep over in the Persian Gulf area. I can that makes a little more sense. I don't know. I mean, parsing kind of the words in that CNA study, it seemed that they came down on a one hub, keep the Western Pacific strong, and then go for the global presence. So they're almost coming down on a kind of a dual navy, if you will. One, the high end, built around the carriers, and then another on the cheaper ships, but higher numbers of those less expensive ships, be the LCS or joint high speed vessel, whatever. It seemed that was kind of, I mean, they presented it more as here's the options, and they didn't necessarily choose one, but it seems like that's the one they thought would probably make the most sense, and that would still allow the U.S. to remain a maritime power. On the non-line of sight missile, that's an interesting one because the LCS, the only armament it really has is a 57-millimeter cannon, I believe. And the idea was you'd put these rockets in a box, these missiles, instead of the vertical launch system they have in larger ships, you'd take this smaller package that the Army was developing, and you'd still have a precision missile that could range out to the version they were looking at to about 124 miles, and so combine that with your helicopter or drones or something, and you've got some pretty good strike there. But now that the Army's canceled this system, or is requesting to cancel this system because it's too expensive and it's just simply not working, it kind of leaves the Navy in a bit of a bind here. So is the LCS mission capable at this point? I'm not sure it is. I mean, until they get some kind of a long-range strike option. I don't know what is on the horizon there. I don't see what other missile they're looking at.
Yeah, tomorrow morning over at my home blog, I have a post out kind of outlining real shortly, because we've been beating the drum about LCS for years, and it's just the gift that keeps on giving on how not to run a program. And I think we have another example of risk has two sides. You take a risk, and sometimes you win. And you take a risk and sometimes you lose, but there's smart risk and stupid risk. And I think LCS, what we see again and again, is they minimized the technology risk and what I call joint risk. I don't know if you're familiar with the ACS program, the Airborne Common Sensor that went Tango performance years ago. And that non-line-of-sight missile is the same thing. It's joint risk. There is a huge risk when you go joint that when your partners all of a sudden say, it's broken, it ain't working, and you combine that with the technology risk where you design a ship around a weapons platform that hasn't been validated yet, voila, here you go.
Right. And it's so important that a piece of the LCS, because the LCS mission is to screen, basically, is to screen the battle fleet. And it's interesting that the Navy turned away from the whole, you know, the Street Fighter concept, you know, that Sobrowski and some others thought was a good idea back in the late 90s and even the earlier parts of this decade. And decided to go with the LCS. But for the LCS to do that similar mission to fight off those fast attack boat swarms, they need something like this non-line-of-sight missile. They need some way to reach out and hit beyond the range of that cannon. I'm still questioning the wisdom of going away from that, of more of a fast attack crafts, cheaper, larger numbers. I don't know. I think the jury's still out on that one, but the Navy seems to be steaming full.
I think we've reached the point where it's become more of an ego issue than it has become a platform issue. Eagle One.
Well, one of the other things we seem to be focused on is getting these ballistic missile defense ships in place all around the globe. I guess it's better than having a land-based one in Poland, which seems to irritate somebody. But how is that going to impact our future Navy if we have to have all these ships locked into certain locations to provide that protection?
Well, again, and that's one of the key points that come out of the CNA paper. Okay, so the fleet has declined in size, yet the demand signal remains the same. Okay, so and now the demand signal is even increasing, like you said, with having to put ballistic missile defense ships, Aegis cruisers, in the Gulf, in the Med, wherever they're going to put them in Europe, and how do they meet that mission on top of everything else? And you know, these are questions I don't hear anyone in the Navy honestly addressing, is how they're going to meet all these demand signals coming from the combatant commanders who say, I need this asset and I need it here. I don't know. It is really baffling, to be honest.
Yeah, let me play Commander Dark Cloud here for a bit. When you make a decision on what type of fleet you have, and if you make it today, there's a long lag time between direction and guidance, commander's intent, and a ship coming pier side and its 12 friends performing a mission. And when you look at 2025, 15 years down the road, that's where you're going to get myself and my 12 buddies are able to carry out a mission if you make the decision now, plus or minus a few years. And when you look at the five options, I've kind of put them into four groups. You had the two hubs and the one hub. That's kind of the old American Navy. We're forward deployed. We're forward presence. You know, let's have the flag out there. We're ready to poke you in the eye. You had the shaping force, which is kind of the Fleet Admiral Jerry Hendricks influence squadrons, and with a little bit of different flavor, if you want to look at it that way. And then you had the surge, which is kind of the we're coming back across the pond, we're coming home, we're retrenching, we have other things like paying our debts that we need to be concerned with, we're tired of fiddling in other people's business. And then the fifth option, which I believe in the CNA they classify as the most dangerous, was the status quo shrinks, which is where you drift, which is where you wind up when you don't have leadership with vision, when you don't have clear, direct, upfront, honest discussions about how much money we're going to have to build a fleet with, how much our per unit cost is, and the missions that they need to carry out for the commander-in-chief when he says go and do that. And yeah, I've called in the past that we need an Arleigh Burke moment where you reach down and you grab a freshly minted two-star and go, you know what, shipmate, you're bypassing all these other goobers, and I'm putting you in charge, because we need to break a mold here, and we need to make a strong move forward that we can't keep doing from the leadership point of view that we do. And do you see us kind of just defaulting into that drift? And
you know,
who's a political leader that might be able to force us to go to one of those other options?
You know, I don't see it. To be honest, I don't see a political leader out there willing to really take this one on. At least I don't see it right now. And like you said, that you know, CNA, their worst case scenario was the status quo, where you know they just make proportional cuts across the size of across the fleet, so everything kind of drifts downward, which means
kind of like what happened to the Royal Navy.
Right, exactly. Well, and they said the hollowing out of the fleet, because then once those numbers start to decline, then it starts impacting training and all that, and so your readiness drops pretty quickly. So no, I don't see anyone really taking up the mantle, if you will, of is the U.S. going to be. So here we are, we're watching the rise of various nations. I'm not one who thinks that China or others pose a real threat, but presence is going to be very important as these other powers rise, as they buy more ships, as they become more assertive in their foreign policy. So as that's our strategic future, then how on earth are we going to allow ourselves, our maritime dominance, to wane? I don't know. I think I think we need a real reordering of priorities here. I mean, I see a little bit of it. I like this whole focus on the air-sea battle, this groupthink between the Air Force and Navy. At least it tells me that some big minds are thinking on this one. But again, I don't, you know, I just look at the numbers, the budget numbers, and I don't see how it happens. I don't see how they come up with a fleet that's big enough to address these demand signals.
Yeah, I've been intrigued by the air land discussion as well, especially if you're talking about any type of action in East Asia. If you're not engaging the enemy with aircraft and naval units, you're going to get a lot of people killed on the ground. Eagle One.
Yeah, I'm kind of looking at Wayne Hughes's new Navy, whatever the new Navy, I get this wrong every single week, the new Navy, which, you know, has a big blue water force or a substantial blue water force, and then also a substantial brown water force, which is cheaper, provides that presence. Can we do that? Is there a way to divide our Navy and put some money, some big money into big ships that need to be out in the blue water, and some little money into smaller ships that can go do all these presence missions?
Well, you can do that if you have a smaller ship that's not the LCS, I think. I don't see how they do it. And and they're smaller, their notion of the small ship, the smaller, cheaper is the LCS, because it's not. So you have to go to a Corvette class or something smaller, something that's more affordable that you can get bigger numbers of. But I think you hit on it. I think that's got to be the answer, is that you focus on, okay, so your blue water fleet becomes a Western Pacific fleet. And then you begin trying to build up your numbers of the brown water Navy, of a presence engagement Navy. Why you need something on the lines of the LCS, I don't know. I mean, I think they can do it with something else. But I don't see it out there. I don't see them thinking about it right now.
Let me ask you a question that touches on something you brought up near the beginning of our discussion. And I believe you were at the Milblog conference in D.C. a couple of weeks, weren't you?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I walked right by you. I was like, hi, yes, Greg Grant. I didn't go over there and poke you in the rib. Sorry about that.
But no, I
hold with pride the fact that I got the biggest Heisman on a question on any panel. And it's because it's a very uncomfortable question, but it folds into what you brought up. And that was personnel costs, especially when you're looking at a future fleet that you almost have 1.5 to 2 admirals per ship. Personnel costs are getting heavier and heavier And when you kind of benchmark what other Western militaries do, comparing personnel cost to China or Indonesia, that's just foolish. But you have to look at comparable cultures. They do some things. For instance, sure, you can retire at age 43 if you want to, but you're going to wait a dozen years until you get your retirement pay. There are ways to control your personnel costs. And some people say, well, you know, to look at it from the gravedigger's point of view, is the World War II generation is going to be passing away, so we should be saving lots of money on personnel costs from them. Not really. What do you see are as the top two or three big cost drivers when it comes to personnel costs, and what are those uncomfortable things, whether it's delaying receiving retirement pay, restructuring the way retirement pay is done, like most companies have done, or just going a few years without a pay raise we may have to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think either that or you have to cut force numbers. And I kept expecting that at some point they'd say, all right, we're gonna trim the size of the Army and the Marines. We're coming out of Iraq. We don't have the same need for the same force levels. Why then did they make the decision to increase the size of the Army and the Marines? I don't understand that one. I mean, I think that's what's really, to be honest, putting the squeeze on the budget right now. And what do you do within the personnel costs? You know, I'm not sure. Is it addressing TRICARE or reducing the benefits? Boy, that's a tough one to pull off. I don't think any congressman is going to be able to do that. I don't know. I mean, there's going to have to be some really difficult decisions on the labor side of things. You know, who suffers and who takes the hit on that one. I do think, though, that at some point they've got to reduce the overall force size numbers. I don't see how else you make it work. The force is simply too big. The personnel costs continue to rise. They cannot get them under control. And I don't know. I think that's your only answer.
Eagle One, you get the last question.
Oh, let me get a really hard one here. Well, if you can't control personnel costs and you can't cut other people, I guess, are we stuck where we are? I mean, are we really into this CNA decline by the status quo, or where do we go?
You know, I think they need to make – I think some hard decisions need to be made here. And again, you know, then you start getting into BRAC issues and who loses the carrier and who's what Congress, what politician, what lawmaker's willing to lose a carrier in their home district. You've got to cut out some of these super costly platforms. I don't see any way around it. And then I think they made a mistake by going with the LCS. I think they you need something for those lower end engagement missions, but you got to have something that's affordable that you can buy in large enough numbers that you can maintain those presence missions around the world, that you can do the counter piracy, the counter narcotics, all these kind of, you know, the littoral missions. But I don't see how they get away with not cutting the number of carriers. Especially when you look out and you see the ballistic missile submarines coming online and the expenses involved there. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a blue water navy in the Pacific, and then and some kind of smaller brown water navy.
As with everything else in this line of work, it's going to take good leadership, and it'll be interesting to see how that comes on. Hey, as we come down to our last minute, we'd be remiss if we didn't embarrass the woman who hates to be embarrassed. Greg, real fast, if people wanted to read more of your work, where would be the best place for them to go?
You know, you can look at dodbuzz.com. That's one place, or defensetech.com. I write for both websites, and they are both military.com properties.
Excellent. And Greg, thank you very much for coming on board MidRats and talking with us today. I'd like everybody to please join us again next week, where we'll be discussing the national security issues in the 2010 elections. See you next week, and have a great Navy Day.
Thanks, Craig, and happy birthday, Mary Ripley.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys.
That's